Okay, hello everyone, and thanks for joining us. Could I just get a confirmation from those who are on the call here that you can hear us? If you could give a thumbs up in the top left. Okay, good. We are ready to go. Hey, I'll just ask if you bear with us for a minute here. My co-presenter, Erica Flores, is getting set up to co-present on some of the slides. So bear with us for a minute. We'll get started in maybe a minute or two. All right. Thanks. Thanks, everyone. As I mentioned, for those who are waiting, we're going to get started here, and my co-presenter Erica is going to call in a minute, and I'll just kind of control the slides. So I guess I'll just get started by thanking everyone for joining us today. Today is a big day in the world of the Families First Coronavirus Response Act. First of all, before I get started, I hope everyone is well, their families are well, everybody's safe. It's been a tough couple of weeks. Particularly for us attorneys, as it seems like every day, really, or every evening, new guidance is being put out by various agencies that we are scrambling to provide updates to our clients on. And that happened this morning. We woke up and recently the IRS actually last night put out guidance that's particularly useful for those of you who will be seeking tax credits, who will be providing paid sick leave or emergency or expanded FMLA to individuals. The IRS last night, late in the evening, provided some information about what documentation you need to get, how the process is going to work. And that's what Erica will be kind of discussing today. It's also an important day because it's not only April 1st, which is really FFCRA day one, it is also your host's birthday today. I'm the host here today. Hopefully, Eric is able to call in a few minutes. Today is my birthday. So it's my 42nd birthday today. It's an interesting birthday to have. One of my friends texted me earlier and said, "Happy isolation birthday, Gannon." So I said, "Well, thanks for that." Oh, and everybody's chiming in saying happy friends. So nice. It's not an April Fool's joke. I actually was on his 42nd birthday. So thank you all. I really appreciate that. It's certainly an interesting birthday for sure. My co-presenter today.
Hey John. Can you hear
Erica.
Me?
She's here. I can hear you, Erica. Can those on the line, the attendees who are all, so many happy birthdays, really. I really appreciate it. I'm getting some warm fuzzies here. Can you all confirm that you just heard Erica as well? Erica, just announce yourself.
Hi, everybody. It's Erica. We're having a little bit of tech difficulty, so hopefully you can hear me all right.
Cool. Yeah, I think we got you there, Erica. No worries. So
great.
That being said, you know, everybody here, we only have an hour. We want to have some time at the end for questions. So and we will make these slides available. We get that question quite a bit. We had a little bit of difficulty last presentation. For those of you who have joined our kind of series here, we really thank you. My colleagues, Mary Lou Fabo and Amelia Holstrom, did an absolute bang-up job discussing this new Families First Coronavirus Response Act. We had a little bit of difficulty getting the slides to everyone. The software we're using was not being friendly, but we sent them out in a client alert, We had a link to them in a separate client alert. We'll try to do the same thing for these slides. We'll get them to you. If you want them, if you don't get them within a day or so and you really want them, just shoot one of us an email. Okay, Erica's email is there. My email is here. So that's what we'll do to get things started. What are we talking about today? We are talking about guidance. We're talking about guidance that the department, the U.S. Department of Labor, has put out important guidance on answering a lot of the questions that we've had on this new, paid emergency, paid sick leave law, the expanded FMLA rights. They really kind of over the weekend came out again. The Department of Labor and these agencies are just, they're driving us bananas here because they keep putting this stuff out, late at night, early in the morning. But over the weekend, some really critical information came out that myself and Erica are going to be talking about. But before we go further, we need to note something important. This is just guidance. Okay, this does not have the force of law. Okay, and this is important to understand because we anticipate that the United States Department of Labor will also be putting out formal regulations. All right, and those formal regulations will take precedence over this informal guidance that they've put out. We think that the regulations will, in many ways, mirror. And if they don't mirror, be very close to the guidance that we're talking about today. But we don't know that. We don't know that. So you need to stay tuned. And I know it's terrible to be on day one of this, right? Employees are eligible to take this leave as of today, and all we have is guidance. But I just want to point that out before we go any further. The other thing I wanted to point out, the last webinar we did, if you need the slides, we can get them to you. But what did we do last time that we're not going to talk about today? Some of the details, like a detailed review of what people get, expanded FMLA, what kind of notice you have to put out. There's a poster requirement. Who's a covered employer? Which employees get this? How much do you have to pay them? Caps, things like that, part-time employees. How do you handle those? Those are all the things we're not going to get into today because we covered those in the last webinar. And we want to make sure we're kind of keeping this stuff fresh. So, before I do that, and before I kind of hand it over to my colleague Erica, I just wanted to do this. Again, we're not going to do a quote-unquote detailed review of emergency paid sick leave, expanded FMLA, but for those of you who may be joining for the first time, let's just do, a minute or two, a quick summary of what's going on. Okay, today's April 1st. That means employees, for covered employers, okay, employees are eligible for emergency paid sick leave, okay, EPSL. That's the easiest way I can explain it. If they are unable to work, okay, or unable to telework, right, for one of the six reasons listed there. Okay, the first three reasons are kind of, we call those the quarantine reasons, or they have COVID-19 symptoms, okay, and they're seeking a medical diagnosis. Right, those are the first three reasons. The other three reasons are a little bit different. They're caring for someone. Who's in self-quarantine, they're caring for a child who is out of school right now, no daycare. That one's bolded for a reason. That's important. That's the one we call reason number five, because that has a lot of implications with respect to what we're talking about today. That's reason number five. Reason number six, an employee is experiencing substantially similar conditions to those that have been outlined from some agencies. That's beyond what we're kind of talking about today. This is a very kind of quick summary. And the other kind of note I want to put is somebody qualifies for reasons 1 through 3 for paid sick leave, they're going to be entitled to 80 hours, okay, 80 hours of paid sick time for full-time employees. The Department of Labor's guidance says that's 40 hours or more, right? So someone's expected to work less than that, they're part-time, they would get a part-time equivalent to those 80 hours. If the reasons are 1 through 3 here, first three, I don't have a pen here, but I wish I did. Reasons 1 through 3, 100% of pay. Okay? If it's reasons 4 through 6, they get 2/3 pay. All right? And then the other component to this whole law is this expanded FMLA, right? That's basically kind of try to keep these separate. You got paid sick leave, you got an expanded FMLA. Expanded FMLA is only available to employees for reason number 5. That's that bolded reason there, okay? And it's employees would get an additional 10 weeks of paid expanded family medical leave for that reason number five at the two-thirds pay. And there's been some confusion because I said, wait a minute, John, I think that's 12 weeks. I don't think that's 10 weeks. And I explain this as actually 10 weeks because the employee most likely would use the first 2 weeks of that paid sick leave. Okay, so that's going to make up their 12 weeks. So this is kind of the easiest way I can explain it. All right, that being said, I know people have a lot of questions. What I'm going to ask is maybe if you could hold off on the questions until the end. We're going to try to leave 15, 20 minutes or so at the end of this to answer questions to the best that we can. But I just ask that you kind of hold those until the end, and we'll get to them. So that being said, I'm going to turn it over to Erica. And Erica, just let me know when you want me to change the slides, okay?
Got it. Hey, so the first couple of questions that the DOL addressed in their guidance that we want to talk about are sort of the different types of employees who might be eligible. And the big, you know, question that we got a lot of was about whether they're eligible if you have shut down your business. And the answer to that question is no. The paid sick time and paid expanded family medical leave are for really illnesses and an inability to get childcare. They are not designed or intended to cover employees who are out of work simply because there's no work for them to do. And so if you have closed your business either because you don't have enough work or you did it because your business is not essential and the governor requires you to close, that doesn't matter. It doesn't matter whether you closed the business before or after today. Your employees will not be eligible to collect paid sick time or take expanded family medical leave under these laws merely because they are out of work. You can go ahead and advance it, John. So what about for those of you who may have a business that's open, but you have put some of your employees out on a furlough, either, you know, sort of a temporary leave or even an actual layoff? The answer to that question is the same, because, again, we're talking about being out of work because there's no work for you to do. Not because of a reason related to actual illness or childcare. However, these folks probably will be eligible to collect unemployment. Massachusetts expanded its unemployment rights, and they are now making unemployment available to those who are temporarily unemployed because of a lack of work, provided that they have an expected return to work date. This is what they're calling standby status, and it's limited to a maximum of eight weeks. You may have already been getting calls from the department asking you to verify that somebody's out of work and give you an expected return to work date. But this is the best option for employees who really don't have work to do. They're not going to be able to get the benefits under the new federal FFCRA. Go ahead, John. Same really here if you have reduced their hours. Maybe they were working full-time hours and now you're giving them 2 or 3 days. You cannot, pay your employees to make up the difference and expect to get a credit back from the government for it. That is, again, not a qualifying reason for somebody to take paid sick time or expanded family medical leave under this new law. But once again, it's possible that these employees may be able to collect some kind of partial unemployment depending on how much they're making. The DOA is actively encouraging these employees to file. So they do have at least some possibility of getting some additional relief. Go ahead, John. Thanks. So turning to the guidance that we got this morning, what kind of documentation can you require under the new law from your employees to support a request for sick time or expanded family medical leave? The new guidance specifically requires that a request from an employee has to include at a minimum the following sort of basic information, right? Their name, the period of time that they want to take the leave, a statement of the reason, which is going to be one of those six reasons that John mentioned at the beginning of our webinar today. What the guidance refers to as written support for such reason, we'll talk a little bit about what that might mean, as well as a statement that the employee is unable to work, including by means of telework, because of this reason. So for folks who don't have a sort of remote work option, who need to be on site if they're going to work, that would be an explanation as to why they need the leave and aren't able to work either on site or remotely. Go ahead, John. So if this request is for childcare, then the employee is going to have to include all of this information. Now, this is, I think, what the IRS probably meant by written support or written support for the claimed reason, right? The name and age of the child or the children, the school or daycare center that's, closed or unavailable, a representation from the employee that nobody else is going to be providing care for the child. Importantly, if the child is over the age of 14, then the employee has to identify special circumstances as to why that child needs somebody to take care of it during daylight hours. Essentially, the IRS is taking the position that if your kid is 15 or older, they can probably hang out alone during the day unless there's some special circumstances. If the reason is due to a quarantine, then the employee has to include in their statement the name of the governmental entity that has ordered the quarantine or the name of the healthcare provider that has recommended a self-quarantine. And if the quarantine is not of the employee itself, but someone else that they need to care for, then the employee is going to have to advise the employer as to that person's name and their relationship to the employee, whether they're a spouse or a family member or what have you. There is no indication in the guidance that a backup documentation can be obtained from the healthcare provider itself, but the IRS also didn't say that you couldn't request that kind of a documentation. So that bit remains a little bit unclear. The DOL guidance previously suggested that you could get that kind of paperwork, and then they deleted that information from the guidance and said, we defer to the IRS. So I think we're going to have to wait to see what the regulations actually say on that issue. But going back real quick to requests for childcare purposes, you are allowed to request documentation of the actual closure of the school if you want to. So an email from the school administrator, something along those lines, or a posting in the newspaper or something like that. Go ahead, John. I think beyond documentation. As far as getting the tax credit, the IRS guidance has made clear that you need, as an employer, to really create and retain two types of documentation. First, documentation that shows how you determined how much money to pay the employee. And that's going to require you to have a record of work performed, which you should keep anyway, hours of telework, and how much qualified sick or family leave they took or used. Additionally, you're going to have to document how you determine the amount of qualified health plan expenses that you have allocated to those wages. The IRS has published significant, substantial FAQs on these issues for businesses to help them do these calculations and has even created a new tax form for businesses whose payroll taxes are less than the amount they paid out, that they can use that form to then request in advance. So that's a little bit beyond the scope of what we want to cover today, but that guidance is out there. I think if you have specific questions related to your specific circumstances, you probably want to consult a tax advisor or professional for help in those areas. Go ahead, John. So I think this might be the last of my piece here. How does the new federal law interact with employer-provided paid time off? So as a general rule, employees are not allowed to take both. They can't say, I'm going to take my sick leave and I want my vacation time on top of it as well for the same hours. They're going to have to choose one or the other. But you as an employer are permitted to allow your employees to sort of supplement their paid sick time or paid family leave wages with paid time off that you provide as an employer. And this, of course, would only be available if they're getting only the 2/3 of their pay, which is only for some of the reasons. If they're getting full pay, then they're not going to have anything to supplement. But it has to be by mutual agreement, which means that both the employer and the employee have to agree that you know they're going to use their paid time to sort of supplement their pay under this new law, and they can't take more than they would otherwise earn. And keep in mind, you know, that you are not going to be allowed to collect a tax credit for an employee's use of paid time off that they already had accrued as part of some policy or benefit through your company, including regular old Massachusetts earned sick time. You know, they're going to use that time and to supplement, but it's not part of this new statute, and you're not going to be able to recover it from the government. So I think that is the end of my section. Thank you, John, for handling the slides. I'll turn it over to you.
Yeah, you bet, Erica. And really, hats off to Erica here, who was the one who was responsible for going through that IRS guidance that dropped last night. That's super critical. I mean, for anybody out there who, which most of you will be, let's be honest here, I've got a couple hundred people on this webinar today. Most of you at some point, well, maybe half of you, let's use that, are at some point you're going to have somebody who's going to need this leave and you're going to see a tax credit. Maybe more, maybe less. I don't know, about half. I'm just throwing that number out there, but a lot of you. So you got to understand now, early on, what type of documentation you need to get from the employee and you need to keep, so that when you're in a position to seek that money back from the government, you have the appropriate paperwork in place. So really, that was an awesome job, Erica, by summing that up. Let's get back to some of the issues that were addressed by the Department of Labor in their FAQ section that I was talking about at the beginning. The first one, intermittent leave. Everybody's favorite topic, right? For those of you, you know, one of the difficult components to this new law is that employers who are less than 50 employees are covered by this new law. And many of them are saying, well, I don't even know what FMLA is. I've never even seen a medical certification. I don't know how that process works. And for those of you who have never dealt with FMLA, you have the added advantage of never having to dealt with intermittent FMLA. Intermittent leave is, let me just kind of explain what that is. For those of you who are smaller, never had to really deal with this situation. Intermittent leave is a situation where an employee can use the time off sporadically. They call up on Friday, take some leave. Call up on Monday, got to take the leave again. They call it the Friday-Monday Leave Act for a reason, right? Then an obvious joke there. But that's kind of the way intermittent, and it's a real challenge. I mean, for those of you who are over 50 employees, have dealt with this for years, you know how challenging it is to deal with intermittent leave. Here's what the Department of Labor told us about intermittent leave. And to be honest with you, I've kind of thought about this. Wouldn't it be nice, for those of you who have dealt with intermittent leave, wouldn't it be nice if this was the way all intermittent leave worked? Wouldn't it be nice if the state of Massachusetts, someone from the state of Massachusetts is listening right now, and you know, everybody's really concerned about paid family and medical leave coming to Massachusetts in 2021. Wouldn't it be wonderful if this was the way intermittent leave worked all along? Both sides have to agree. Both sides have to agree to the new intermittent leave schedule. If either side doesn't agree, we're likely going to be the employer who's not going to agree to the intermittent leave. Guess what? They have to use it all at once. They have to use it in a block, or they have to use it for the paid sick leave component. They'd have to use it until they're not experiencing those symptoms anymore. Okay, but they have to use it. They can't just come into work, you know, a couple of days and say, "Oh, I'm not feeling well." And that makes sense, right? Given the nature of the spreadability of this terrible disease that we're dealing with, do you really want people coming into the office on Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, taking Thursday and Friday off because they're not feeling well, because they have, COVID-19 related symptoms and coming back into the office next. No, you don't want that. So that's at least part of the reason why this kind of intermittent leave, this significant departure from what we're used to with intermittent leave has come out from the Department of Labor. But again, both sides have to agree. Now, let's assume both sides agree. Okay. If someone's a teleworker, okay, they're working from home, they can use the intermittent leave for any of the six reasons that I discussed at the outset, okay, of this webinar. And that makes sense. They're home, even if they are sick, maybe they can work, okay, but they're not going to bring it into the workplace. If someone is on site, okay, if somebody is working on site, the only reason that they can use intermittent leave is that reason number five, and that makes sense. You don't want these people coming into the workplace. You don't want them to feel like they need to come into the workplace. So the only reason you could use this kind of, and it's kind of intermittent leave is sporadic leave. It could also be partial day leave. So I have a kind of hypo here where I explain a little bit about using intermittent, kind of this new paid sick leave or expanded FMLA for a partial day circumstance. Let's suppose you have someone who is teleworking. Okay, teleworking. And they come to you and they say, hey, you know, things are getting kind of challenging. Either a family member, or I'm not feeling well, family member's not feeling well, I got to care for that person, or kind of the more common scenario that I think a lot of you will be dealing with over the next maybe several months. Hopefully, well, we don't know, but it's the situation where schools are closed and an employee is responsible for caring for their child or children. And, you know, a lot of parents right now are responsible for things like homeschooling. I know there's probably people on this call that understand what that entails and the challenges associated with that. I have a 7-month baby at home. I know that the challenges aren't the same with respect to homeschooling and things like that, but she has certainly figured out over the last couple weeks how to get attention. She screams, and it's working, believe me. But that said, that's kind of how intermittent leave, we see this coming up. People saying, look, I can't work a full 9-to-5 day because I have childcare responsibilities. How about if I work partial days? How about if I work 9-to-1? That's permissible, and I'd encourage everyone to be flexible when thinking about that situation. If employees do begin coming to you telling you, hey, I know I'm teleworking, but I just can't do it during these hours, be flexible with them and understand that intermittent leave is an option under those circumstances. 12 weeks total. Okay. I want to kind of point this out because this is a question that we have been getting over the last couple weeks. Maybe some of you are familiar with this, maybe not. But some people think, okay, employees have this expanded FMLA rights, right? They have this opportunity to kind of take this new family and medical leave. Does that mean they have an extra, is this just like a bucket of 12 extra weeks that someone can take FMLA for? And the answer to that is no. No, that is not the case. It doesn't add an additional 12 weeks to an employee's, and I'll use the word FMLA bank, right? Employees are eligible for 12 weeks of FMLA, including expanded family and medical leave in your FMLA year. All right, so you know, last 12 months is what you're looking at. So an example I think that I didn't put on this slide, but it was used in the Department of Labor guidance, is that let's say an employee back in January, that employee used 10 weeks, or we'll say a December, January, and part of February. The employee used 10 weeks of FMLA for a surgery, right? Or to bond with a newborn, right? They're not going to have an additional 12 weeks of emergency FMLA. They might only have 2, all right? So just understand that it's 12 weeks total. And you probably understand this now, but your employees might not, all right? So be prepared to explain this to your employees who are coming to you thinking, hey, I get the extra. Hopefully everybody sent that poster out, right? You got the poster up, everybody. If you don't have that poster up, got to get that up in the workplace. We recommend emailing that around if you haven't sent that around because a lot of people are working from home, not going to see the poster. So
So just understand, employees should have, all of your employees should have had an opportunity to see that poster already, right? And that poster does not explain really some of the concepts that we're talking about today. So be prepared to talk about that. One other point before I move into kind of the two last topics, I think there's two more topics, and then we'll go into questions, which is good. We'll have plenty of time for questions today. That's great. Is this notion that emergency paid sick leave, right? Not the FMLA, but the paid sick leave, that is in addition to the 12 weeks of FMLA. And this is, I pulled the language straight from the guidance because it kind of explains it pretty well. Paid sick leave is not a form of FMLA. All right, therefore, it's not going to count toward the 12 work weeks in your 12-month FMLA period. Right, so if somebody recently used up all their 12 weeks of FMLA, they'd still get the 80 hours for full-time employees of paid sick leave. All right, so we tackled that. One kind of confusing issue that's kind of come up in connection with this 12 weeks total is, well, let's say I know that paid sick leave doesn't count toward the 12 weeks. That is the general rule. However, if the paid sick leave is used for reason number 5, all right, that's that. Again, I bolded it at the beginning. I think someone asked, can we go back to the 6 reasons? I'll do that at the end here to kind of leave us on that slide as we go through questions, so that's cool. But I just wanted to point out, if somebody uses the paid sick leave for reason number 5, that actually would count toward the cap, assuming they're getting paid for that time, okay, if they use it for reason number 5. All right, so that's a little bit of a wrinkle there. Just make sure you kind of understand that one going forward. All right, so 2 final points, and then we're going to turn this over to I have some people. Maybe I didn't explain the – let me just kind of repeat this because I was stammering through it a little bit too much. If an employee uses paid sick leave for that reason number 5, all right, to care for a child who's home from school, school's closed, daycare is closed, that use of paid sick leave and that use of paid sick leave alone would count toward the employee's 12-week FMLA total. All right, so conceivably, I guess the best way I can explain this is, let's say somebody's never used FMLA. Maybe you're under 50 employees, maybe whatever the case might be. If they use the paid sick leave for 2 weeks, they'd have 10 weeks of expanded FMLA to use, 10 weeks of any FMLA to use. All right, so 2 final points that may not apply to everyone. All right, so if you don't find yourself in these 2 categories, these 2 categories I'm going to talk about, I'll mention it because if you need to take a break, you need to send an email, that's cool, and then we'll get back to questions. These 2 topics are healthcare providers. All right, if you work for an employer, if your business is employs these quote-unquote healthcare providers, we need to talk because you need to make some decisions on how you're going to handle that. And then the last thing I'm going to talk about before turning it over to questions is small businesses. So for those who are under 50 employees, there are some kind of different rules for you as well. So let's kind of talk a little bit about, and that's why I mentioned it, that doesn't apply to either. You don't have healthcare workers, you're way over 50 employees. You can take 5 minutes here to send an email. I won't be offended. But all right, healthcare providers. This was a biggie. This was a significant component to the Department of Labor guidance that really, quite honestly, kind of shocked me. I don't know if Erica's still on the line here, but you know, we as a firm were kind of looking at this saying, wow, this is expansive. In essence, the easiest way to describe this is the statute, the new paid sick leave, or the FFCRA, I guess, states in it, hey, look, what the Department of Labor can do is allow employers to exclude healthcare workers from this law. So these healthcare providers, I guess, is the specific term, these healthcare providers, they're not going to be entitled to any of this leave if you choose to exclude them. And so we kind of kicked around, well, what does it mean to be a healthcare provider? And what we did was we looked at the actual FMLA regulation said, okay, you know, there's certain care providers. The easiest way to explain this is anyone who could lawfully and enforceably sign a medical certification. All those medical certifications that you've been looking at for years, it would be someone who could sign one of those. Easiest way I can explain it. But then over the weekend, we get this expansive definition in the questions and answers that were put out by the Department of Labor. And it says, and it's not only these direct care individuals, right? It's not only the doctor, not only the nurse practitioner or the social worker who could be excluded. It's anyone employed at any of these entities. And look at how broad this language is. I mean, it's not just the doctors. It's a hospital, healthcare center, medical school, the nursing facility, home health, retirement. I mean, it's the list kind of goes on and on. And then it has some bolded language. Again, or any similar institution, employer, or entity. That's broad. That's broad language. And is that really what we want here? I know that there are some healthcare workers or healthcare employers that are probably listening right now. Do you want to exclude everyone from that? I don't know. I mean, that's a business decision that you're going to have to reach. You know, one of the things we've been kind of talking these and they're not huge healthcare providers, right? Because they're not going to be subject to this law. It's not the major hospitals out there. They're over 500 employees. Kind of the smaller health clinics, some of the retirement nursing homes. Do you want to exclude everyone? Just exclude some people. Do you want to exclude people from everything, or do you just want to exclude them from part of it? Do you really want to, do you really want to exclude your whole workplace from the paid sick leave provisions of this? Think about that. Think about some of the ramifications of not giving anyone the right to take paid time off if they're experiencing COVID-19 symptoms. I'm not sure that's the best. And again, I can't speak for everybody on the phone here. I'm up on my soapbox here, but I don't know if that's the best for everyone. One thing employers are considering doing in this space, saying, here's what we'll do. We'll let everybody take the paid sick leave, right? Because that's, by and large, that's mostly for people who are sick. But you know what? We may not be able to extend expanded FMLA to these individuals, right? Now, that's kind of meeting in the middle. Maybe that's the better practice. But do think about some of the other ramifications, legal ramifications that could be associated with saying, we're not giving paid sick leave. Well, one thing, what about OSHA? What's OSHA going to think about that? Are you requiring sick people to come to work? The optics of it sound somewhat concerning. So that's something you really want to think through before you just kind of put out this blanket notice, nobody's taking this leave, right? The other thing I want to point out, also includes this. Yeah, sure, Erica.
Sorry, no, I just wanted to point out, too, that on this point, the DOL seems to have recognized that this is almost seems contrary to good healthcare practices as far as the, you know, use of paid time for sick-related purposes goes anyway. And they actually instructed employers in the guidance to make these decisions judiciously, which may be their way of trying to encourage businesses to think pretty long and hard before allowing, you know, or essentially forcing somebody who may be ill to come into work by not giving them time off at a place like a nursing home or a retirement facility where you have a lot of high-risk people. So I echo everything John said. This is an incredibly broad definition, and you really do want to think carefully about how you want to apply it.
Agree. Couldn't agree more, Erica. And that kind of brings me to my last bullet. Are the regs going to change this? Are we going to see something in the regulations that limits this to not everybody that's employed at one of these entities, but only the direct care? I don't know, but that's something to keep an eye on. I know I'm getting some questions about, hey, will my facility qualify? I'm going to stay respectfully away from those questions, because if it's a close call, that's a question we have to talk about offline. That's a question we have to talk about with you about, well, what do these people do? And I don't want to kind of, in fairness to everybody else, I don't want to spend too much time going back and forth of whether someone's going to qualify for as a healthcare provider if it's a close call. But you'll get the slides. You can always email myself, email Erica, email any of the attorneys at Scholar Rabbit. We're really working around the clock with clients on all things FFCRA. But so finally, let me just talk for a few minutes before we turn it over for questions about this small business exemption. All right, so I think what's going on here is, and this comes from the FFCRA itself, it comes from the guidance, the individuals who put this law into effect, I guess, they understand that employers under 50 were never really supposed to have to deal with this stuff, at least at the federal level. And that's why you have the language in the regular family and medical leave law that says, look, this only applies if you're 50 or more employees within the 75-mile radius. But this new law, this is a real problem. We're facing a crisis right now. And I think they felt, hey, look, to let small employers off the hook completely, well, to Erica's point, is that accomplishing the goals of keeping sick people out of work and limiting the spread of this disease? It doesn't. So what the kind of compromise here is they said, okay, here's what we're going to do for small businesses. This is businesses that have less than 50 employees. You will be exempt. You can claim an exemption. You can claim it. I think that's the better word for this. And I'll explain some open questions regarding this small business exemption in a minute. But in essence, the way it works, you got less than 50 employees, you can make the determination, I guess is the better word. An authorized officer of your business can determine in good faith, okay, in good faith, mind you, that, hey, look, if we give paid sick leave, okay, or expanded FMLA, big bold, reason number 5, we'll go back to that at the beginning. If an employee of the small business needs to take the time for reason number 5, and that, if assuming a lot of employees do that, if that would jeopardize, or even one, if that would jeopardize the viability of the small business, okay, you can show, you have to meet one of these, I have the 3 bullets here, right, that an employer would have to show in good, well, determine is the better word, determine in good faith that one of these three bullets apply, okay, and the application of these bullets would quote unquote jeopardize the viability of the small business. All right, financial obligations. You're going to go broke, right? I mean, if we do this, you know, we're going to have such an outlay. And I get it. There's a tax credit. But there's going to be such an initial outlay to pay this that we're not going to have enough money coming in. Okay, that would kind of be one justification here. The other one, we're going to have half our employees that are going to be out. We're not going to be able to get the work done. There's no way to get this work done if, you know, 25 or 35% of our workforce is out because they're caring for their children who are out of school, right? And then that's kind of linked to the third bullet. Look, we're not going to have enough workers, not just getting the work done. We're not going to have enough workers to even, you know, perform the overall tasks that we're responsible for performing here. And there's no way we can't operate at a minimum capacity. Okay, that exemption is out there. You should, if you're under the 50 employee threshold, and you think that compliance with this law, if a decent size percentage of your workforce applies for expanded FMLA or they need to take paid sick leave to care for their children who are out of school, if you're saying to yourself, yeah, you know, if 4 or 5 of my employees claim this, is this going to really jeopardize the viability of my business? That's a discussion you should be having now with Labor and Employment Council, because now's the time to think about how are we going to approach this small business exemption. One question that I get a lot here is, well, is there anything we're going to need to file, like submit to the Department of Labor in order to get approval for this small business exemption? We're not aware of anything at this point. Whether the regulations will clarify that, I don't know. Whether something will come out tomorrow or probably at 11 p.m. this evening to really ruin my birthday if I'm up that late, maybe they will come out with something that says, well, this is the form that the small business needs to fill out, and this is where they have to submit. So I don't know. I can't say that now. But I do know that, you know, as of today, there's no – unless I'm missing something, Erica, there's nothing that a small business would have to submit in order to get that exemption.
Not aware of anything, John. Not yet.
Yeah.
I have a hard time believing that they won't want something, but I don't know. I honestly don't. We'll have to just wait and see.
Yeah. Well, I agree. Okay. So here we have 15 minutes. We did a good job today, Erica, leaving time for questions. So I know the questions are coming in.
We're going to do our best to answer them as they. Erica, can you see those?
No.
No.
I think you're going to have to read
okay.
them out. Yeah.
Oh, boy. Okay. That's fine. Yeah, sorry, everybody. We had a little bit of technical difficulty. But for those of you, you know, sign up for our blogs and our client alerts, please. We're putting out a lot of – I think we have a client alert going out today. It may have already gone out on the IRS guidance that Erica was talking about today. So make sure you're signed up for these. You can shoot me an email. We have these. Just a word. Usually we leave it on this screen because we're attorneys and we have disclaimers all over the place. But I'm going to go back to the initial slide that someone had asked about the six reasons and in particular reason number five. But just understand, you know, we put this information out. This is should not be construed as legal advice, right, because everybody's listening. There's no attorney-client relationship involved in what we're discussing today. So it shouldn't be – this is informational purposes, but do check in with us. I mean, if you have questions, this is – you know, one thing I'm going to do before I get to the questions is, and as I scroll back is, you know, we know there's a lot of individuals that you can talk to about these issues, right? There are, you know, people who are responsible for, you know, administering your health care, things like that, that may have, you know, tax professionals, right? Not tax attorneys, tax professionals. That's great. I mean, those are great resources. We encourage you to use them. But let me just tell you something. If there's a serious issue in the workplace, let me give you an example. Somebody gets sick. Someone comes down with this terrible illness, and you're thinking, what do we do here? What do we do? Who do we send home? That's a conversation. Think twice. That's a conversation I'd encourage you to have with your attorney so that the attorney-client shield privileges that conversation. So that being said, other conversations you want to have with people, that's fine. You know, go and do that. But that's a serious conversation that you need to be thinking about. You know what? I think I do need to talk to my lawyers about this one because, you know, we want to make sure that conversation is privileged. So that being said, here's the quick summary slide at the beginning. I am going to go up to the top here. I know we got a lot of questions. I'm not going to be able to probably do all of them, but I will kind of go through these. Oh, I got to go through all the happy birthdays first. Awesome. Thank you, guys. Thank you, everybody. So nice. Okay. Erica. All right. So let me kind of start.
Hey, John, are you going to make a cake that's shaped like the coronavirus?
No. No, because there's too many little pointy things on it. If you guys see all those logos, they have all those little – this is a true story, though. This is a serious issue, so I try to make it as light. If we can, bring some smiles to people's faces. Somebody who brought a smile to my face was my wife this morning, who actually went outside, put a sign up on our mailbox that says, happy birthday, John. Beep the horn if you know to make noise because she knows I'm down here in my work area here, and she wants people to kind of acknowledge that my birthday. So thank you to Sarah for that. So let me kind of talk to you. This is a good question. Does the FFCRA – cover employees who live with someone who is high risk, right? And that, so they're staying away from home to avoid exposure because someone they live with is high risk. My initial reading of that is unless they have been ordered, really, to stay home by a medical professional, that's probably not going to be covered by the FFCRA. Erica, do you kind of concur with that? It's just someone who's saying, made the personal choice, hey, I don't want to put my family member at risk by going to work.
Yeah.
I'm going to stay home.
Yeah, I agree. I think just the sort of fear of getting it, even if it's because they have older, you know, parents at home or young children or a pregnant spouse, none of those are good enough on their own. You have to have a healthcare professional advise you to stay home, you or your family member. And otherwise, I don't think you're going to qualify.
Okay. Yeah. So I think we're in agreement on that one. Here's one. Can an employee be paid the 80 hours of sick time? And then if the employer chooses, can they start paying the employee again? Presumably, if they are still out of work for one of the six reasons on the slide there, or they're out of work for something else, I don't see why not. I don't think that I don't think that would jeopardize your ability to get the tax credit. I think is really the question here. That's a big question everybody has is not should we pay it, but if we pay it, we're gonna get the money back. We can get the money back if we pay this. I think you would. I don't think that
continuing to pay someone, and presumably they'd be out of their own company-provided paid sick time, right? Because we covered this in the last webinar. I don't know if Erica mentioned this, and that's okay, because I think we discussed it in the last webinar, but these 80 hours are different than anything that somebody already has in their sick time bank, right? So presumably they use the 80, they use whatever company-provided sick time they have, maybe they got an extra 40 hours. I would be fine with you continuing to pay that person, and I don't think that would jeopardize your ability to get the tax credit.
Yeah, I agree with that. I would just point out that, you know, you're not going to get a tax credit for the voluntarily continuing to pay somebody. You'd only get the credit for the actual time that they took under the new law, the 80 hours.
Yeah. Paperwork. So people are asking about forms. Whether there's a form to fill out for the different exemptions, maybe the small business exemption, I think, what about documentation, right? All this documentation that is there, like this new medical certification, right? The EFML medical certification that you need to provide to employees to provide to their healthcare provider to get back to approve the leave. I'm not aware of any forms like that at this time. Will they come out within the next couple of weeks? Probably. I think probably.
Well,
I think a lot of employers are going to say, what do you think, Erica?
Well, I was going to say it sort of goes back to that issue in the IRS guidance about whether you can get documentation from the healthcare provider or you just have to take the employee's statement as being good enough. And I think right now the IRS guidance suggests that you have to just accept the written word of your employee. It doesn't have any language that would allow you as an employer to require some kind of a doctor's note. Right now it's kind of an open question, but it's possible that we'll see in the regulations that will be clarified.
Awesome. Yeah, that thanks for supporting me on that one. I have an employee who's been on unpaid leave for the last 2 weeks due to school closing. That I don't need to tell people to raise your hand if that's a situation, because I know a lot of people have been in that. They just can't work. And so they have to be home with their kids. If it's an on-site type of job, teleworking is not an option. Well, what else can you really do here? Those employees, they're out, they've been on leave. The question is, can you now start paying them under expanded FMLA? And it would also be both, because they'd be eligible for reason number five here, even for the paid sick leave. Or do you want to wait for them to initiate a request, right? Do you want to reach out to them? Do you need to wait until they reach out to you? Yes, conceivably, the employee is the one who needs to initiate the request. However, let's kind of be practical here. If you have people who have been out, did you send them the poster, first of all? Did you do that? Did you at least email them? Did you put them on notice that they may be able to take this leave? I mean, if they're out of work, they haven't, maybe they're not checking their email, they're not coming on site, just putting up that poster, well, I'm not so sure that's going to cover it if people, they don't have access to that, right? So I think under the circumstances, I'd probably encourage you to reach out to that employee and maybe let them know, hey, this is available if you want to use it. I'm not saying I'd say that in every situation, but that would kind of be where my initial gut would go, so that these people could take advantage of this, not take advantage in a negative way, but avail themselves of these benefits, and then they come back to work. So, and then get the tax credit. So that's kind of what my gut says on that one.
Yeah, and I would just add two things. The first is, you know, I think if you have employees that do not routinely use work-related email, that you may want to think about just putting the poster in the mail to them, to make certain that they're going to be able to get it. And because you have an obligation to post it, and I think that you know, implied in that is an obligation to make sure that it's made available to them given their circumstances. And the second thing, I think, is that for the purposes of getting the tax credit, you need to get that written request from the employee. Whether you initiate the conversation or they do, ultimately you got to get that request in writing and keep those documents so that you have all of your documentation in order in case the IRS comes asking you about whether you actually should get the tax credit.
Yeah, so I have a question. Some people missed some of this. Will the recording be available to all of us? Let me kind of say, we're in the process of creating what we're calling kind of a COVID-19 resource material section of our website. I hope it's going to be ready and rocking by the end of this week, maybe over the weekend. And that is the goal, is to put things like our recordings of our webinars, PDFs, links to blogs that we've done, links, helpful links to other websites that have important information like the CDC and things like that. So that should be hopefully available within the next, you know, week or 10 days. So thanks for asking. Does it matter if an employee is exempt or not exempt with intermittent leave? No. No, really the question with intermittent leave I think you should think about is, can they telework, right? Because that might kind of change the game. What about parents alternating the care for their children? Intermittent, good for them? That's what intermittent's for. I mean, that's kind of my easiest way to explain that. That's really probably the biggest reason why you would grant intermittent leave, is because parents are saying, you know, guys, I can't do this anymore. This is just getting too much. Can I work the situation out where, you know, from 9 to 1, I work, you know, my husband teleworks from 1 to 5, whatever the case might be. But that's kind of I think the classic reason why you would grant intermittent leave. Intermittent leave can be case by case. Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, you can agree on one hand and not on the other. I don't think that's going to trigger potential FMLA issues. Could it, you know, if you don't have a legitimate kind of business-based reason for granting it to one person and not another, you've got a whole other host of problems, right? Discrimination, right? Well, they're just doing this. They're not going to let the older workers, they're not going to let them telework. So that's kind of the concern there. But yeah, you can look at it on a case-by-case basis. Just understand what your rationale is for doing that. Do we have the updated poster to send out today? We have it. I can, if you want to send myself or Erica an email, we can send it to you. You can find it online, though. I mean, we'd love it if you want to email us, we can send it to you. But if you just kind of Google FFCRA poster, you should probably lead you to two, the federal employees, government employees, and non-federal. But if you need any assistance with, like, cover letter language or cover email language to go with the poster, particularly those who are thinking about excluding or exempting some employees from the rights that are listed in the poster, check in with us, because you want to be careful about how you message that. Is there a form that has the option number 5 on it? Yeah, no forms that we're aware of yet. So we shouldn't run FMLA concurrent to COVID-related illness for the purpose of 80 hours of sick leave. What about beyond the 80-hour period? It would run. Yeah, I mean, in essence, it would run concurrent with FMLA. It would draw down their 12 weeks of FMLA if they're using it beyond the 80 hours of paid sick leave. Question here. Most of our work staff is working from home. Some cannot work. And what we'll do is I'll go to like 105 here, because with this new guidance that came out, I'm already in the background. I can hear all the emails coming in. So I just want to kind of be fair to everybody and respectful people's time. We'll go 5 minutes over here. But again, if you have questions, I don't get to them, you can shoot one of us an email. We'll do our best to turn around a response as quickly as I can. Most of our staff is at home. Well, that's, a lot of people are in that boat. Our firm is in that boat, right? Some cannot work due to the type of work they need to do because the office is closed. They need to come in. We're currently paying them. They are not eligible for the sick leave, correct? Correct. Yeah, they're not. The reason they can't work is not related to one of the 6 reasons here. And Erica kind of touched upon this a little bit. Hey, look, if your office is closed, and that's the reason why someone can't work, they're not eligible for these benefits.
Yeah, they may be eligible for unemployment, though.
Yep.
At least for a limited period of time.
Erica, could you do us a favor? The 15-year-old understanding. I think someone was saying they dropped off, and this person actually wished me a happy birthday, too. So I'll see if you can maybe – what was that on the 15-year-old?
Yeah. Yeah. So for if you are taking care of a child that is over the age of 14, and you want to use your sick time or your expanded FMLA for that reason, when your employee makes that request, they're going to have to not only, you know, identify the reason, give you the names and ages of the children, you know, some documentation of the school or child care center being closed. But for those older kids, they're going to have to identify special circumstances as to why you need to take care of those kids during daylight hours. And I think that the rationale for this is, now it probably doesn't apply if you have a teenager and a five-year-old, because you still got to take care of that five-year-old, obviously. But if you just have teenagers at home, the DOL wants you to explain, why can't you leave those kids at home alone during the daytime? They're old enough, and there must be some special reason why you feel that you need to stay home with them, rather than being able to go to work. And that, so that is the requirement for kids who are over the age of 14.
So I think we got that one. Cool. Thanks, Erica. So here's a tough one that I know someone here is dealing with that's a little bit outside the bounds of what we covered today, but I want to talk about it because it's a tough situation. It says, with paid sick leave, those who have recently tested positive for COVID-19, beginning today, they're going to be eligible for the 2 weeks of leave. Yeah, they're going to be eligible for that. You may want some, you know, medical documentation to confirm, but let's just common sense. But here's the kind of bigger one. How do we manage this going forward? How do we monitor, determine whether they're still eligible, you know, when they've recovered? You know, the paid sick leave law does say you can take it, you know, up to the 80 hours until you're, and I apologize. I don't have the exact language in front of me, but you certainly can get a return to work note from the employee. I don't think there's any kind of concerns there. But I'm sorry to hear that that's a situation that you're dealing with. That's a tough one. I don't know, Erica, if you have any other kind of thoughts about, you know, how I guess a return to work note is fair game. Once they use up the 80 hours, they wouldn't be eligible for anything more. But maybe offering them an opportunity to take, you know, whatever company provided benefits, that's a good idea. Maybe even extend them, you know, an unpaid leave of absence to make sure they're good to go and they're not going to spread the disease to anybody else in the workplace.
Yeah, I think all of those are advisable, just as a matter of prudence, but also for purposes of avoiding risk under OSHA, under, you know, ordinary negligence laws. You know, you want to make sure that you have some kind of a guarantee from some healthcare professional that this employee is clear of the illness and ready to go back. They may think that, okay, they've been out 2 weeks, they're not going to continue to get paid. They don't have an obligation to quarantine anymore, but there's nothing that I've heard or seen that says that this illness dissipates within 14 days in every case. And so I think getting a return to work note is really smart in that
cool.
circumstance.
Yeah. Awesome. So we'll do kind of two final questions here. I know everybody's got a lot of them, and I'm sorry I didn't get a chance to get to all of them, but believe me when I say we're doing our best here. One good question. Business is open. Okay, business is open. You're an essential business under Governor Baker's order. Okay, but the employee says, I'm not coming to work. I'm petrified right now. I can't come in. You know, and a lot of times what we're seeing is someone saying, look, I got a child, or I'm living with a parent or a significant other who's at significant high risk. I can't risk going to work. Terrible, terrible situation. The whole thing's terrible. The whole thing stinks, by the way. Let me just get that out of the way. The whole situation stinks, particularly my isolation birthday. But someone's fearful they can't come in. They would not be eligible for one of these six reasons. If it's just their own kind of, hey, I can't do this, but they may be eligible for unemployment. They wouldn't, but they would not be eligible. Now, that could change. Let's say you've got reason number two on there, and a healthcare provider provides a note that says, look, this person should self-quarantine because of risk factor A, B, and C. Maybe you got a different – maybe there's a different thing. Need to care for someone? I don't know. That situation can change. But by and large, the question is, hey, if someone's just, I'm fearful, I don't want this to happen, they would not be eligible for the benefits.
And on that note, just quickly, I do think that they could get unemployment, but they have to have they have to be able to demonstrate that there's sort of a reasonable risk associated with their going to work. I think in a circumstance where they have high-risk people at home, they may be able to make that case.
Two more questions, because one's easy. Are the first 2 weeks for reason number five paid? Yes. Yes, they are. They are paid for paid sick leave. An employee can take them unpaid if they want. I don't want to go down that road, but just think that they are paid. Last question. Great question. Will Scholar Abbott provide a template or form for taking FFCRA that includes the kind of required documentation, name, healthcare plan? We're working on it. We are 100% working on it. We were working on it this morning. I don't know the status of where it's at, but we are going in that direction. If the Department of Labor has not put out the appropriate forms for you to have give to your employees and use for your record keeping purposes, we're going to try to get something that may change, right, if the Department of Labor changes what those forms are, but we understand that might not come out. I know I'm going fast here. That might not come out for a little while. We are working on that. So kind of stay tuned on that. Check in with us. You know, if we have a form, what we might do is do a client alert with that form in it. I don't know what we're going to do, but we are working on that. So thank you, everyone. Thank you for kind of joining us. I hope we were able to give you some useful information today. And we hope you enjoyed the webinar. So stay safe, everyone, and thanks for attending. Okay?
Thanks, everybody. Bye. Appreciate it.
Thank you. Bye now.